Well, for those of you that are here, this is a part of a very brief course on an introduction to science and faith. This is the second lecture I've given. And this is a way you can contact us on social media at Reasons to Believe. I'm the founder and president of Reasons to Believe. And if you text my name to 31996, that's your portal to get lots of free videos, book chapters, articles, and much more. There will be a lengthy time for Q&A this morning, and we'll be taking questions both from you people that are here in person and also from the live streaming audience. And if you don't get to ask your question, I got good news for you. I do answer questions on both Facebook and Twitter, so feel free to contact me there. All you need to do is put in Hugh Ross Facebook, Hugh Ross Twitter, it'll pop right up. This talk is based on an experience I had. It was an international debate community, and it was all full video, so I was seeing these skeptics from around the world, and it was a scientist in Ireland who said, okay, how do you use science to establish that there must be a God? But I want to see if you can use science alone to go from deism to theism and theism to Christianity. How do you establish that it's Jesus Christ as the creator God of the Bible? And so I told her, well, there's three ways it can be done that I can think of, and I'm going to give you one of those three ways this morning. And that's why I've titled this talk, Cosmic Reasons to Believe in Jesus Christ. And if you want a quick outline, we're going to look at the cosmic evidences for a transcendent God, and then move from that to evidences. By transcendent, I mean a God that transcends space, time, matter, and energy, to establishing that that transcendent God is a personal, loving God, and finally, that it's a redeeming God. And that's where you really establish that we're looking at the Christian God as opposed to the gods of the other religions of the world. Now, since this is a class or a course on science and faith and science and the Bible, I am going to show you how the Bible makes these claims, but at the same time show you how from science alone we can establish these characteristics of the one that's responsible for the universe. Now, personally, I started reading in cosmology when I was 7 years of age. In fact, the first book I read in cosmology was a book by Fred Hoyle, Nature of the Universe. And it's interesting reading that book because he had two chapters where he poured out venom against the Christian faith. He clearly did not like Christianity. And I don't know why he put that in his book. Why is that in the book? But it kind of shows you that he must have had some bitter experiences with Christians during his growing up years. But this is what he said in Nature of the Universe. He says, there's a good deal of cosmology in the Bible. It is a remarkable conception. I read that at age 7, didn't really look at the Bible till I was 17. But I remember at age 17 saying, Hoyle is right. There's a lot of cosmology in the Bible. In fact, there's more than 10 times as much about cosmology in the Bible as there is in all the rest of the holy books of the religions of the world combined. And if you're not familiar with that term, cosmology refers to the origin and history of the universe. Now, I have found that no matter where I speak in the world, everybody knows one verse of the Bible. It's not John 3:16, it's Genesis 1:1. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. But it's not the only verse in the Bible that speaks about a singularity beginning. Now, that's a physics term, which means an actual beginning of matter, energy, space, and time. And these are a few of the passages in the Bible that speak about that space-time beginning. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. I remember as a young man going through the Bible trying to find where the Old Testament talked about the universe. You will not find the word universe anywhere in the Old Testament. There is no word in biblical Hebrew for universe, but they have this phrase, the Shamayin Ares, heavens and earth, and where it has the definite articles attached, it means the totality of physical reality. And it shows up 9 times in the Old Testament, always referring to the totality of physical reality. And when it uses the word create, In Genesis 1:1 is the word bara, to bring something brand new into existence that never existed before. So right there in the first sentence is a claim that there's a being that brought into existence the totality of matter, energy, space, and time. In the New Testament, Hebrews 11:3 says that the universe that we can detect did not come from that which we can detect. And what can we humans detect? Matter, energy, space, and time. Now, I was reading the Bible at age 17 for the first time, which happened to be that also the time when physicists in Britain and South Africa were developing the first of the space-time theorems. And now we have over 30 of those theorems. Probably the one that's having the greatest significance is this one. I got it right here if you want to take a look at it. Where it says inflationary space-times are not past and complete. Known as the Borde-Guth-Vilenkin theorem. And hey, if you want to read something that's really fascinating, I encourage you to get this. You can get it at Physical Review Letters. It's just incredible reading, especially if you love tensor calculus. You won't be able to put this thing down. But it does end with a conclusion we can all understand, which is the following. Any universe that expands on average throughout its history has a space-time beginning, implying a causal agent outside space and time who creates space-time, matter, and energy. Now, the significance of this is the non-biblical gods claim that God creates inside space and time. That's what you'll see in the Eastern religions. Unique to the Bible is a claim that God creates independent of space and time. Space and time don't exist until God creates the universe. Now, Alexander Vilenkin, one of the three authors of the space-time theorem, made the point in a later book, about a year and a half later, he wrote this. He said, with the proof now in place, cosmologists can no longer hide behind the possibility of a past eternal universe. There is no escape. They have to face the problem of a cosmic beginning. Now, he didn't really address what that problem was, but I think it's clear. Proof of a space-time beginning implies that there must be a causal agent beyond space and time who creates our universe of space-time, matter, and energy. In other words, a transcendent God must exist. And this actually you can see in the latest books being published by atheist astronomers and physicists. They're conceding that they can't take deism off the scientific table because of the force of these space-time theorems. That was kind of the basis of that scientist in Ireland. She says, I can see from your writings how you get deism. Now tell me how you can get from deism to theism, to Christianity, using science alone. I don't want to hear from the Bible, she said. But as I mentioned, I'm going to give you a little bit of Bible so you can see how to integrate the Bible and the science. So a transcendent God must exist, but is this God personal, and did he design the universe and earth for the existence, and as we'll see later, for the redemption of billions of human beings? Now, as much as the Bible says about the beginning of the universe, it actually says much more about the expansion of the universe. You won't find it in Genesis, you won't find it in the Torah, but it does actually show up in the oldest book of the Bible. The oldest book of the Bible is not Genesis, it's Job. Content of Job predates that of Genesis by at least 400 years. And in Job 9:8, it says, God alone stretches out the heavens. That's typically how the English translations put it, the stretching out of the heavens. The Hebrew verb there is the verb natah, which means the expansion of what's being described. And as you look at these 11 texts, it shows up in all three Hebrew verb forms, the perfect, the imperfect, as well as the cal participle form, which means these are actually talking about the expansion of the universe. Many years ago, I debated the executive director of the Skeptic Society on a university campus, Michael Shermer, and he claimed that these passages were just pure metaphors, figures of speech. when you actually see that the verb is in all three Hebrew verb forms, it literally is telling us that the universe is continually expanding at the hand of God. Now, I think the reason why Shermer was disturbed by this is that no one even thought about an expanding universe outside of Bible scholars until the 20th century. And actually, you can see Jewish scholars 800 years ago, 900 years ago, looking at their Bibles and saying it's talking about an expanding universe, but no scientist drew that conclusion until the 20th century. So this is evidence that the Bible has predictive power, that was able to predict a feature of the universe that scientists hadn't discovered until the 20th century. Now, I've written a whole book, The Creator and the Cosmos, that lays out the best evidence that we live in an expanding universe. I don't have time to give you the best evidence because it's kind of technical, but I will give you something that's easy for all of you to see, a visual demonstration that we live in a continuously expanding universe. And it's thanks to the Hubble Space Telescope. So on the left here, you see an image of galaxies located 12 billion light years away. And on the right, a different part of the sky, we're looking at galaxies 2 billion light years away. And I put both of these images to the same spatial scale. So what you see is that as you go forward 10 billion years, galaxies have spread apart from one another. 12 billion years ago, the galaxies are jammed so tightly together, they're tearing spiral arms off one another. But as the universe expands, we now see that the galaxies are so far apart that now becomes a rare phenomenon. The universe is expanding. And what we see in Jeremiah 33:25 and several other passages, the claim that when God created the universe, he created it with fixed laws. The laws that govern the heavens and the earth are constant. They don't change. And so the same laws we see today were in operation billions of years ago. Something we can actually measure by looking at the spectral lines of distant galaxies and quasars. In fact, they show us that there's been no change in any of the laws of physics to 16 places of the decimal. So again, another demonstration of the Bible's predictive power, and makes the point that one of those laws of decay, one of those laws is a pervasive law of decay, the book of Romans. The entire universe is subject to this law of corruption or this law of decay. And you actually see that spelled out in some more detail in the book of Ecclesiastes. Now, I was debating a quantum physicist at the University of California, Santa Barbara, many years ago, and he said, a lot of this evidence you're giving for God from astronomy is qualitative. I want to see quantitative evidence. Can you actually pull numbers out of the Bible that I can check with actual measurements to see that your claims are true? Give me a numerical prediction. And so my response was that, okay, we know that the universe has a space-time beginning. It's been expanding from that space-time beginning. Under laws of physics that don't change, where one of those laws is a pervasive law of decay. I says, you're a quantum physicist. You know that the second law of thermodynamics tells us that any system that expands will get colder as it expands. For those of you that are not physicists, think of your car engine. When the piston chamber expands, the gasoline cools down and stops burning. When it compresses, it reignites. If you've got a diesel engine, you don't need a spark plug because the compression is so extreme, it's enough to raise the heat to ignite the gasoline. But when the chamber expands, the gasoline stops burning. That principle applies to everything in the universe, which means the universe, as it expands, must get colder and colder in a highly predictable way. And if we know the age of the universe, which we now can measure it to four places of the decimal, that allows us to come up with a biblically predicted cooling curve for the universe. Here is that biblically predicted curve. And overlapping it, I show you 14 measurements we astronomers have made of the past temperature of the universe. There are certain spectral lines that we can look at that are proportional to the temperature of the universe. And the latest measurement is the one you see in the middle. And the error bar on that is so small, it's smaller than the thickness of the line that you see there. It perfectly fits the biblically predicted cooling curve. Other measurements, likewise, are consistent with, therefore, there is that numerical prediction. And the Bible got it right. Now, where we get the personality of the Creator is the discovery that the expansion of the universe must be fine-tuned to a very high degree to get life, and especially to get human beings. And today we know what the dominant factor is that governs the expansion of the universe. It's something called dark energy. How many of you here have ever heard of dark energy? Okay, almost all of you. I'm impressed. It wasn't discovered until 1999. Wow, this has gotten good news. But one reason why you probably have heard of it, astronomers now know that it makes up a little more than 70% of all the stuff of the universe. Dark energy is a dominant component of the universe. And dark energy, the best way to describe it is it's the energy embedded in the space surface of the universe. And so you can think of the universe like planet Earth. Planet Earth is a three-dimensional body, and we humans live on the two-dimensional surface of the three-dimensional Earth. The universe is four dimensions in all the stars and galaxies, and all the space-time dimensions are on the three-dimensional surface of the four-dimensional universe. But as that surface expands, dark energy becomes progressively more powerful in its capacity to accelerate the expansion of the universe. So, for example, for the last 7 billion years, the universe has been expanding at a more and more rapid rate. This being 2019, the universe will expand more rapidly than it did in 2018. Now, a question I often get is how much of the expansion of my waistline can I blame on dark energy? Well, it's less than a quadrillionth of an inch per year. Anything beyond that has got another cause. Okay. But here's the principle. If you expand the universe too rapidly from the cosmic creation event, gravity will not be able to collect any of the cosmic gas to make galaxies, stars, and planets. And life will have no place to live. And life will have no possibility of originating. On the other hand, if you expand the universe too slowly from the cosmic creation event, gravity will collect all that gas and compress it into nothing but black holes and neutron stars, where the density exceeds 2 billion tons per level teaspoonful, a density so extreme, molecules are impossible, atoms are impossible, even protons and electrons are impossible. And of course, life would be impossible. An astronomer several years ago calculated the degree to which you have to fine-tune dark energy in order to have the universe expand at the just right rate all the way through cosmic history. Because one of the things they discovered, it must expand more slowly when it's young and more rapidly when it's old in order to get the kind of bodies showing up at the right time so that physical life is possible. And what they discovered is it needs to be fine-tuned to one part in 10 to the 122nd power. If you were to ask me as a scientist, where do we find the most impressive evidence for fine-tuning design? It would be in the dominant component of the universe. Dark energy is where we see the most spectacular, measurable evidence for fine-tuning design. You say, well, that 122 zeros kind of blows my mind. Can you give me some idea how to visualize it? Well, one way we've been able to do this, you'll see this in a couple of my books, is to compare the level of fine-tuning design we see in dark energy to the very best example we humans have ever achieved. And in my opinion, that would be the LIGO instrument, the gravity wave telescope that a few years ago first discovered gravity waves. Now they found quite a few objects that are emanating these gravity waves. By far the best machine we human beings have ever invented or designed. But when you compare it to the fine-tuning design of dark energy, it ranks 10 to the 97 times inferior. Now, Who invented this amazing machine? Physicists at Caltech and MIT. And I was on the faculty of Caltech for a number of years. The people there are not, they're brilliant. They rank among the smartest people on the planet, the best educated. But what this evidence is showing us is that the one that designed dark energy is more brilliant than those Caltech and MIT scientists. Better educated and more knowledgeable than those Caltech and MIT scientists, and better funded than the US government that made possible the building of this amazing instrument. And I think you're getting the gist here. What we're establishing is that the one that created the universe is not just a transcendent entity, but a personal being, because only a personal being can manifest the attributes of intellect, knowledge, creativity, and power, and evidently is doing it at a degree far, far beyond anything we human beings were capable of. Now, I think you would understand how someone who is a Christian astrophysicist would draw this conclusion. What impresses me in the scientific literature is that even atheist theoretical physicists are also drawing the same conclusion. And I have a paper here that you can read afterwards, Disturbing Implications of a Cosmological Constant. Cosmological constant's another term for dark energy. And when these three theoretical physicists, all of them atheists, published this paper, it caught the attention of another famous atheist, Philip Ball, the physics editor for the famous British journal Nature. And so he interviewed these three theoretical physicists, and he published his interview in Nature News. And I'm going to pull a couple of quotes from that interview. Here's the first one. Arranging the cosmos as we think it is arranged, that is where we got dark energy, say the team, would have required a miracle. And Philip Ball was impressed that these three atheist theoretical physicists would use the word miracle. But they went on in the interview to say, an unknown agent beyond space and time intervened in the evolution that's the history of the universe for reasons of its own. Again, if there's dark energy, which explains the title of the paper, Disturbing Implications of a Cosmological Constant. As atheists, they said, if dark energy is real, it shows that there must be this agent beyond space and time performing miracles for reasons of his own. Hence, they concluded their paper with this final sentence. Perhaps the only reasonable conclusion is we do not live in a world that is a universe with a true cosmological constant. In other words, they said dark energy can't be real. Now, the irony of this paper is it was published just several months before we astronomers came up with 9 independent observational demonstrations that not only is dark energy real, it's the dominant component of the universe. And I wound up writing a short article in each one of these 9. You can access them at reasons.org. Here's a brief list just to show you some of the observational sources for this. I won't go into the technical details. There's no need for that because you can go to the URL I have there on the bottom, reasons.org/articles/RTB, dark energy articles. That will pop up for you not only a brief description of these 9 observational demonstrations, excuse me, but I'll also give you 16 more. Because today we got 25 demonstrations, observational demonstrations, that dark energy is real and is a dominant component of the universe. Now, what does this mean? It means we really are stuck with an agent beyond space and time performing miracles for reasons of his own, which means we really are looking at a personal being that's responsible for bringing the universe into existence. Now, I mentioned that dark energy is the most spectacular measurable evidence for fine-tuning design, but it's not the only evidence. We have many more evidences. So, for example, all of the forces of physics must be fine-tuned. It's important to fine-tune the ratio of electromagnetism to gravity to 1 part in 10,000 trillion trillion trillion. If that's not the case, you either get a universe with no stars or a universe where stars form and instantly explode, or you get stars that form but have no capacity to sustain life. So there are many other features where we see fine-tuning design at a level beyond what we human beings are capable of manifesting. And beginning in 1991, our team at Reasons to Believe began to go through the scientific literature and collect the number of these different features of the universe and the laws of physics that showed this fine-tuning design. And as you can see, the numbers have gone up with every year that's gone by, affirming the principle you see in Job and Psalms, that the more we learn about nature, the more evidence we uncover for the supernatural handiwork of God. And so you can see over the course of 20 years, that evidence has gone up dramatically. And it's caught the attention of physicists and astronomers who are not believers. The agnostic astronomer Paul Davies wrote this in his book: "The impression of design is overwhelming," referring to the characteristics of the universe. If you want to read more, you can get the latest edition of The Creator and the Cosmos, and we're actually giving away a free chapter. Reasons.org/Ross is your gateway to get a free chapter of that book and free chapters of other books as well. Now, in my office at Reasons to Believe, I've got over 40 books on the fine-tuning design of the universe, virtually all of them written by unbelieving astronomers and physicists. And so it's conceded today amongst astronomers that when we look at the universe, we see, in the words of Paul Davies, overwhelming evidence for design. But that's where they stop. And by stopping the universe, they can keep God at an arm's length. What we've done at Reasons to Believe is say, if there's fine-tuning design at the level of the universe, and if this is the God of the Bible, we're also going to find overwhelming evidence for design at all size, scale levels. And so what we've discovered is you not only need a highly fine-tuned universe for life, you need a very special kind of galaxy cluster. Tens of thousands of clusters of galaxies we can see in the universe. Of all those clusters of galaxies, only one has the characteristics that permit the existence of advanced life. And guess what? We're living in that just one. And we see no other galaxy cluster like our galaxy cluster. You also need a just right galaxy. Over 200 features of our Milky Way galaxy must be fine-tuned for advanced light to be possible in our galaxy. Now, I don't know about how many of you are Star Wars fans, but we astronomers have looked at galaxies far, far away. None of them have the characteristics that permit the existence of advanced life. The vast majority don't even have the characteristics that permit the existence of bacterial life. So they need to rewrite those scripts for all those Star Wars movies. You also need a just right star. Now, stars are easy to measure with high precision. And my colleagues and my fellow astronomers for 60 years now have been scouring our Milky Way galaxy trying to find a twin of the sun, another star that's sufficiently like the sun that it could be a candidate to have a planet orbiting it on which advanced life is possible. They have not yet found a twin. They've found many stars that are twins of one another, but the sun has no twin. And likewise, we need a unique planetary system. You know, we've now found over 3,700 planets outside of our solar system, and the prediction was that they're going to be just like the planets in our solar system. None of them are like the planets in our solar system. And has led to the discovery that every planet in our solar system plays a critical role in making advanced life possible here on planet Earth, even Mercury. All the planets play a role in making our existence here possible here on planet Earth. And of course, we need a just right Earth, and 20 different features of the moon must be fine-tuned to make advanced life possible here on planet Earth. And we did the same thing with these features as we did with the universe. Actually, look at the characteristics of galaxies, planetary systems, stars, our planet, our moon, and say, over time, do we see the fine-tuning evidence give more impressive or less impressive? Again, testing the biblical principle, the more we learn about nature, do we indeed uncover more evidence for the supernatural handiwork of God. Back in 1995, we found 41 of these features described and analyzed in the scientific literature. 2006, it was 676. I've been maintaining a database on this. I can tell you it's well over 1,000 today. We just hadn't had the time to analyze it. But as we did the analysis, what we discovered is the probability of finding a body that can sustain life. And by the way, this is not advanced life. This is just to get bacteria, just to get microbes. That the probability of getting a body that can sustain microbes without the supernatural handiwork of the Creator God of the Bible, that's the last column there. You can see that it's been getting more and more remote as we make more and more measurements. It's such that it gets more remote by a minimum of a factor of 1,000 times per month. So when I speak on university campuses, I tell the skeptics, if you're not persuaded today, wait 1 month and see what happens. And with the evidence going up a factor of 1,000 times per month, that should be enough to convince any skeptic. And this actually made an impression on a famous American physicist, Freeman Dyson. And by the way, if you want to see the documentation for this, go to reasons.org/fine-tuning. That will pop up for you a 300-page compendium where we list all the characteristics, describe them, and give you citations to the scientific literature. Hopefully that'll keep you busy this afternoon. But it was Freeman Dyson who made this statement in his book, Disturbing the Universe. The more I examine the universe, the more evidence I find that the universe, in some sense, must have known we were coming. I mean, the universe we see is the universe of the past because it takes light time to reach our telescopes. But indeed, that's something that astronomers recognize. As you look at the past history of the universe, it's clear it was being step-by-step designed for the future appearance of life and human beings in particular. Somebody must have known that we were coming because that somebody was preparing the universe for our existence. But as we look at the universe in some depth, we also discover it was a creator that was not only intent on preparing a home for us, it was a creator intent on redeeming us permanently from the ravages of evil and suffering. And you say, how can you figure that out? Well, I was on an airplane once with another quantum physicist, a German quantum physicist, and one of the questions he asked me as we were discussing the universe, he said, okay, if there's a God behind the universe, did he really need to put so much decay into the universe? I mean, with all that decay, it's frustrating. We got to keep maintaining and repairing things. It says, a God of love surely would have put less decay into the universe. So why would God subject us to so much decay? And so I explained to him that there's physical reasons and there's spiritual reasons. He says, well, I want to hear the physical reasons first. So, and incidentally, this is something you actually see in Scripture. The entire creation groans. But it says the entire creation groans subject to the law of decay until God has completed the number of human beings he intends to redeem. Once the number of humans that God intends to redeem have been redeemed, it says at that point, his creation will be liberated from this pervasive law of decay. Okay, but the physical reason. If you've got a very high rate of decay, that allows stars and planets to form. Stars can't form unless the universe is decaying at an extremely efficient rate. And incidentally, we benefit from this decay because stars also are an expression of a high rate of decay. Our star, the Sun, is one of the most entropic bodies we can see. And because of that, we got the heat and light that makes life possible. Also, we notice that that very high rate of decay, yes, it does mean you got to do a lot of repair and maintenance, but also means you can eat food. There's no way you could eat food and process that food to be able to do useful work unless there was an extremely high rate of decay operating in the universe. But as I was sharing with this quantum physicist on the airplane, I says, Notice that this law of decay is fine-tuned to be a tool in the Creator's hand to permanently eradicate evil. He says, I got to hear this. And so I said, well, notice that the decay rate is not so high as to discourage productive work. But notice it's not so low as to let the expression of evil and sin go unrestrained. And so, yes, we're all frustrated by the fact that this law of decay means whatever we do needs to be maintained and repaired. But it says, notice the decay rate is not so high as to completely discourage you from doing any work at all. It's not that high. But it's not so low as to let sin go unrestrained. Now, when I was raising my sons, I was explaining to them why I was disciplining them the way I was doing it, and as frequently as I was. I says, my goal is that you be trained in such a way that you wouldn't experience the consequences of evil in your life. But I also made the point of, I don't discipline you, the laws of physics will. And so I explained to them how the laws of physics do that. And actually you see this in chapter 3 of Genesis. The moment that Adam and Eve, our parents, choose to allow evil to come into their lives, what does God say to them? Because of your decision, you're now going to experience more pain and more work, and also it means you're going to be experiencing more wasted time to undo the damage caused by sin. Now, that's something I had to watch out for with my boys, because they basically had, they were very clever at making sure I was the one that undid the damage of their sin. And so one of the jobs of parents is to make sure they're the ones that actually experience more pain, more work, and more wasted time. But notice how the laws of physics make sure that happens. Because as we commit evil in order to undo the damage, the laws of physics are designed in such a way that we're going to experience a lot of extra pain, a lot of extra work, and a lot more wasted time. And we're biologically designed that none of us enjoys any of those consequences. We don't like extra pain or extra work or wasted time. And therefore, we're motivated by the laws of physics themselves to avoid evil and pursue virtue. But in the process, we discover we lack the resources to completely do that. But as we look at the universe, we see that there's a God there that prepared this universe and gave us incredible wealth on this planet to enjoy. And therefore that tells us we're looking at a God that's not only very powerful, but also very loving. And if we can't redeem ourselves from our natural tendencies to perform evil, he must have provided a way out. That's so Job, completely independent of the Bible. And this is one thing I shared with that scientist in Ireland. I says, Job had it figured out without any scripture. What he looked at was the world around him, the heavens, and said there's got to be a God out there that's very powerful, very intelligent, very loving. I'm in a position where I want to be away from evil, but I can't do it on my own. He's so loving and powerful and so smart and intelligent. He must have figured a way out. Therefore, I'm going to trust in what he has provided. And what does he say in chapter 19? Those of you who have heard the Messiah at Christmas, I know that my Redeemer lives, and I will see him on the last day. In my flesh I will see him. Confident because of what he saw in creation. God designed the universe, earth, and earth's life for the redemption of billions of humans in the eradication of evil. See, where do you get those billions? Well, notice that God designed our universe, our galaxy, our planetary system, and planet Earth, so that it can sustain billions of human beings. In fact, I'm writing my third book on that subject right now, the amazing design, because it's one thing to make a planet that can support 100,000 human beings. It's quite another matter to make a planet that can support 7.5 billion and support it in such a way that those 7.5 billion can have the technology where they can hear and understand the gospel message of how they can be redeemed by the Creator of the universe from their sins and evil. God didn't want to just redeem a few hundred thousand. He wanted to redeem billions. And one of the books I wrote on this is Why the Universe is the Way It Is. And we're offering a free chapter at reasons.org/Ross. This book, Improbable Planet, which makes the point that every component of the universe, Earth, and Earth's life, and every event in the universe, Earth, and Earth's life, plays a role in making possible the redemption of billions of human beings. And I'm working on a follow-up to Improbable Planet right now. In fact, I did some work on it yesterday, and I'll be working on it this afternoon. With that, I'd like to throw it open to any question you want to ask. It doesn't have to be in the subject matter. It can be in what I spoke on 2 weeks ago or what I'll be speaking on in future weeks. Next week, I'm going to be speaking on the origin of life and what we learned by attending Origin of Life research conferences over the past couple of decades and how we can use that as a tool to persuade people that indeed there is a God that created the universe and wants to redeem us. But I'll take questions on any subject, but if you've got three questions, please take three separate turns. And we're also going to be taking questions from the live stream audience, but I see a hand over here. Yes. Right, right. Okay, I know you all heard that question. But he was asking me, you know, how do scientists, when they read Genesis, understand the day-night sequence we see in the days of creation there? Well, I'll give you my impression as a young scientist reading the Bible for the first time at age 17. I hadn't met any Christians by that time. But I did have a Gideon Bible. It was given to me in a public school at age 17. I looked at that, excuse me, and this is what I noticed. Each of the creation days was bracketed by an evening and a morning. So I said at a minimum, that means that each day has a definite start point and a definite end point. I also noticed that the word day must have at least three distinct definitions, because three are used there on the first page. Creation day one, it's contrasting days and nights. That's day for the daylight hours. Creation day four, it's contrasting seasons, days, and years. That's 24 hours. Genesis 2:4 uses the word day to refer to the entirety of creation history. That's day as a long period of time. But the other thing I noted at age 17 is that there's no evening and morning for the seventh day. In other words, the evening and morning not being there for the seventh day tells us it's not yet finished. We're still in that seventh day. And as I continue to read through the Bible, I found three texts, Psalm 95, John 5, and Hebrews 4, that tell us we're still in God's seventh day. And that answer for me, an enigma that had plagued me since I was 11 years of age. So what happened to you at age 11? My parents got worried that I was getting obsessive about astronomy and physics. So they bought our family a big thick book on evolutionary biology. I was the only one in the family that read it, but I told my parents the numbers don't add up. There's all this speciation before humanity and hardly any afterwards. Can you tell me why? They said, go ask your science teachers. I asked my science teachers, and they said, well, go to those professors at the university. And they couldn't help me either. But when I picked up Genesis 1, it answered the fossil record enigma. For 6 days God creates, on the seventh day he stops. If you want to know why so many biologists don't believe in the Christian God, it's because they say we look at our biology and we see no evidence for the supernatural handiwork of a God. They're looking on the wrong day. If they're doing their biological research in the human era, they will see no evidence. God's at rest from his work of creating. But if they look in the past, before human beings, they'll see it everywhere. It explains why so many of us in the physical sciences believe, and not so many in the life sciences. Great question. Thank you. Someone from the
here we got a
live stream audience.
Live stream? Okay.
I'll just yell them out. So Tony Z has a question. Do you see, with growing proof that more of the scientific community is becoming believers? If so, if not, why not?
Well, you all heard that question. Are there more scientists becoming believers as a result of this merging evidence? And if not, why not? Well, back in 1916, a philosopher, Dr. Luba, published a paper where he said, 45% of the scientists I've surveyed believe in God and an afterlife. And because of advancing science, I'm predicting that that percentage will radically drop as years go by. And so the survey was repeated in 1996 of men and women here in science. And what they discovered was they got the same number, 45%. And so the prediction made that advancing science would cause belief among scientists to drop proved not to be the case. But it didn't go up either. However, if you look at different disciplines, you could see some movement. Now, it's interesting, in both the 1916 and 1996 survey, mathematicians were at the top. The level of belief was over 80%. And near the bottom were the social sciences. And there seemed to be, in both cases, a correlation where the harder the physical science, the more likely you were to get belief, and the softer the social science, the more likely you were to get unbelief. Now, some people have commented on these research papers by saying there may be a selection effect. Those that are believers are probably going to want to go into a science where things are a little more concrete, and those who are not believers are going to want to play it safe and go into a science where nothing is concrete. So there could be that selection effect going on. The biggest change that they've seen, this happened about a couple of years ago where they did a survey of part of those people, and they found out the physical chemists have risen dramatically in the level of belief, where they're now approaching the level of belief that you see amongst mathematicians. That's been the biggest change. And one thing I did see when I was at Caltech was that there is a big increase in the number of research biologists that believed in God in an afterlife. But it happened after Caltech began to require advanced mathematics for their graduate students in biology. Before that, the level of belief was around 1%. After that, it went up over 25%. So evidently, bringing mathematics into a discipline has a big factor. Okay, who's next? Yes.
Hold on. Earlier in your talk, you showed a curve, and you mentioned that the scientists had asked for a quantitative analysis of, you know, demonstrating that the Bible is scientifically accurate. Just wanted to clarify that. Now, the Bible doesn't have any numbers in it. And, you know, one of the criticisms it gets is that, you know, calculated pi to only, say, 3 instead of more precision. So I'm assuming that what you're saying is the Bible predicted such a curve, and then science showed that it actually happened. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, what I'm saying is that the Bible predicted the shape of the curve. You can get that from the laws of physics being constant, a pervasive law of decay, and a space-time beginning. You do need the data point of the age of the universe to be able to do this very precise numerical prediction. So once you've got that data point, then you can actually fit the curve. The Bible simply tells you what the shape of the curve will be like, but in terms of what kind of numbers you'll get, you'll need the age of the universe added on. What I've noticed is scientists are very impressed that you get that fit with that external data point. That's still a very impressive prediction. As far as the one you wrote about or gave about pi, there are, you know, less dramatic numerical predictions you can pull from the Bible. But it's important to realize that the Bible rounds numbers off just like scientists round numbers off. And so when Solomon gives you the value of pi, he's giving it to you to one place of the decimal. And at one place of the decimal, he got the right answer. Over here.
Would you mind standing up too, if you wouldn't?
The Bible talks about that Satan is the ruler of the air. And we see phenomena in our troposphere, sometimes referred to as UFOs. Can you explain as to what those things might be?
Okay, question was about UFOs. And, you know, 3 decades ago, more than that now, I was invited to speak in the Soviet Union when it was still called the Soviet Union and still run by the communists, on the condition I only spoke to people who had PhDs in science. I couldn't speak to anybody else. And I had to speak on the topics they wanted me to speak on. Well, I gave them a list of 30 different talks I could speak on, and they always chose the most evangelical of those talks. They were starved to hear about God and how God might play into their science. But what really surprised me is the talk they requested the most was my talk on UFOs. And I found out why. The Soviet Union scientists knew that they were way behind the technological and scientific advance of the West. And so they were trying to get a leg up on the West in terms of trying to develop sophisticated weaponry by investing in occult physics. So a lot of the physicists I was addressing had been very much steeped in the occult and had suffered the consequences, including a lot of them having UFO encounters. Now, I've been studying UFOs since I was 16. That's because when I was 16, I was the director of the Astronomical Society in Vancouver, British Columbia. And I said, why don't we have a booth at the Pacific National Exhibition? So we got a booth at the exhibition, and they put us right beside the Flying Saucer Club. So that's when I began to get some experience in UFOs. And you know, they would come by and say, well, what do you think it was? And so, and what I've noticed over the years is most of what people claim to be a UFO encounter is not really a UFO encounter. They say, well, we saw this cluster of UFOs in the horizon. I said, well, was there a window pane between you and the horizon? Why do you ask? Well, there's chandeliers behind you. They're going to appear as lights on the horizon. And it's able to explain away about 99% of what people report as UFOs. But there is a 1% residual. And one of the things you notice about the 1% residual is that when they go through the atmosphere, there's no sonic boom. There's no heat friction, but they crash into the Earth, and when they crash into the Earth is depressed, snow is melt, the vegetation is damaged, but there's no debris at the site. What does that tell you? It's not physical. If it was a physical body, you would get a sound barrier being broken, you would get heat friction, and there'd be debris at the site. But it has to be real, because only real objects can depress the ground, melt the snow, and damage the vegetation. Explains why I differ from a professor I had at the University of Toronto. I had Carl Sagan for a short course. And Carl was insistent that UFOs did not exist, because his worldview did not tolerate the possibility of non-physical reality. As a Christian, my worldview does. God created us human beings as physical, intelligent beings. He also created angels as non-physical, intelligent beings. They exist in a realm that we would define as non-physical reality, or what non-Christian physicists have called interdimensional reality, dimensions that are not part of our space-time dimensions. Jacques Vallée, the famous French physicist who has devoted his whole life to studying UFOs, says, that is where these UFOs come from. But what's interesting is that the closer the encounter you have with a UFO, the more damaging its impact. It's never beneficial. It's always negative. And so Alan Hynek, who spent many decades studying UFOs, he was one that developed close encounters of the first kind, the second kind, the third kind. You've ever heard of that? Okay, they also got close encounters of the fourth kind. That's one you don't want. That's where you get killed by the UFO. But what he noted was a close encounter is where you're within 500 feet of the UFO phenomena. And he says the best you're going to come away with in that case is recurring, terrifying nightmares. Close encounters of the second kind, And third kind, this is where you actually have contact with the being. You get a message from the being. A lot of abductee stories you hear. However, in no case can they prove that their experience was physical. It's always non-physical reality, in spite of the stories that you hear otherwise. And as six different physicists who have devoted their lives to studying this, all of them non-Christians, have concluded, we don't know what's behind this UFO phenomena, but one thing we do observe, there's a one-to-one correspondence to what happens in these residual UFO experiences and what happens in the occult and in witchcraft. And from a Christian perspective, we know what's responsible for witchcraft and the occult are fallen angels, are demons. And I think what really seals the case is there's a number of UFO encounters where they got automatic writing, basically communication from the spirit right into the head of the human being. And this is the origin of what's called the Urantia book. Any of you ever heard of the Urantia book? Okay. It's the UFO Bible, 4,000 pages, actually longer than our Bible. And it was communicated by these so-called UFO beings to human beings. But what's interesting about the Urantia book, one-third of its content is focused on denying the deity of Jesus Christ. So I think that gives you an idea of who's really behind these UFOs. And incidentally, the reason why you don't have as many people here in America having these experiences, there's not as many of us in the occult. During the Soviet era, occult was everywhere, which explains why so many of them were having these experiences. Oh, by the way, if you want to read more on this, we got a book called Lights in the Sky and Little Green Men. A way you can scientifically test what's behind the UFO phenomenon. The good news is this. If you close the doors of the occult, that will be the end of your UFO experiences. You're not stuck with it. Okay, live stream question.
We have another online question. This is from Heddle. I think that's the way you say that. H-E-A-D-D-L. It says, many Christians believe that the earth's decay began with the fall and will return to perfection when Christ renews creation. 2 Peter 3:10 is said to not mean total destruction, but renewal. Your thoughts?
Okay. Yeah, there are Christians who believe that decay, or at least decay at the level we experience, did not begin to impact earth and the universe until the fall of Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden. Nowhere in the Bible does it actually say that. I think where they get that is based on Genesis 3:17, where it says, cursed is the ground. In other words, the ground became cursed as a result of a sin. But if you actually read the whole verse, it says, cursed is the ground because of you. Not because God changed the laws of physics. It's cursed because of human sin. It actually ties in with the end of our message. God designed the universe in advance with his law of decay so when we did sin, we would experience a curse of more pain, more work, and more wasted time. And actually, that curse is a blessing because it's part of the way that God is going to be redeeming us from sin and evil. And so, repeatedly, the Bible says the laws of physics haven't changed. I gave you the one out of Jeremiah 33. Romans says that the law of decay pervades the entirety of the universe. And in astronomy, you can't separate this time dimension from the space dimensions. So Romans 8 is literally telling us the entire universe since the beginning of time has been subject to this pervasive law of decay. Now, some Christians accept that, but they say, well, we think it increased. Well, they're failing to take into account the fine-tuning. Change the law of decay. By making greater decay or less decay, you eliminate the possibility of physical life. That's one of the fine-tuned features of the universe, that entropy or the rate of decay must be exquisitely fine-tuned to make life possible. So the fact that Adam was alive before the fall and alive after the fall is proof in itself there is no change in the law of decay. And the law of decay is good in the sense that it's one of the tools God is using to bring us back from a propensity to perform evil. Okay, who's next?
Do we know yet if there's any evidence of dark matter helping galaxies to form?
Okay. I mentioned that dark energy makes up about 70% of all the stuff of the universe. The second most abundant component is dark matter, makes up 23%. And we're talking dark matter where the matter does not interact with light or interacts very weakly. It used to be called exotic dark matter to distinguish it from ordinary dark matter. But now dark matter is used to refer to the exotic stuff. And there have been people saying, well, we've got no proof of dark matter because we haven't found the particles. Well, we've actually found some of those particles. Neutrinos, for example, are part of dark matter. But it's clear they do not make up even, well, they make up just a small fraction of the dark matter. So most of the stuff that makes up dark matter, we've not yet found the particles. So this is what's causing some doubt. On the other hand, we know that this dark energy is real because of its gravitational impact. And you made a good point there. In order to explain how spiral galaxies can sustain their spiral structure for as long as they do and as stably as they do, one of the requirements for life to be possible in a galaxy is that you need a lot of this exotic dark matter, matter that doesn't strongly interact with light. And we see this all over the universe. So the gravitational evidence is pervasive, but we've not yet found the dominant particles that are responsible for this exotic matter. On the other hand, I think we're really close. There's been a lot of publicity that CERN in Switzerland and France are going to find the dominant particles. I'm placing my bet on astronomers finding it first, and they're going to find it for a lot less financial investment. And since one paper already got published where they said we see white dwarf binaries cooling at a rate that's greater than what we'd expect if there wasn't axions existing in the universe. That's now considered the most popular candidate to make up the dominant component of dark matter. And what this paper was pointing out is that axion decay would actually be responsible for this extra cooling that we're seeing. But in their published paper, the signal-to-noise ratio showing the existence of these axions was just 3.5. And the standard in physics and astronomy is you can't claim it's a real result until the signal is 5 times higher than the noise. We're not there yet, but you know what? There's lots more binary white dwarf stars out there. A study over the course of the next couple of years should be more than adequate to show whether this is actually a signal of axions or not. And I also think that CERN's got a chance of finding it too. The other leading candidate to be the dominant component is something called sterile neutrinos. If you're interested, I've written articles on both sterile neutrinos and axions at reasons.org under my blog, Today's New Reason to Believe. Over here again, where someone, yes.
I have a more personal question. Knowing all your head knowledge that you have about reasons for God and reasons for believing the Bible, do you or have you throughout, since you've become a Christian, have doubts emotionally when you look at like the problem of evil or other philosophical issues with God? Do you ever yourself doubt the existence of God?
Okay.
Emotionally, I mean, not just with head knowledge.
Okay, she's asked me the question, do I ever have emotional doubts about the existence of God? And I think you understand that I seldom have head knowledge doubts, but I think all of human beings, we experience these emotional doubts, typically when we want God to intervene and he doesn't. You know, God, why aren't you helping me in this situation I'm facing? Don't you realize how stressed I am by this situation? Why aren't you doing something? And it's like God speaks back and says, you know, I really want you to benefit from this stress. And if I intervene, you're not going to benefit the way I want you to intervene. I says, but this is unpleasant. And it's like, well, that's part of the discipline that goes through. And that's what Peter says in 1 Peter, is that those of us who are serious followers of Jesus Christ will actually be put through more stress and more suffering than people who are not followers of Jesus Christ. And people say, well, in that case, I don't want to become a Christian. Well, the whole point that First Peter makes, and Paul backs them up in his writings too, that suffering is going to bring you great joy as you come out of that suffering. And I've seen that happen many times. In fact, if you want to read a book on this, Always Be Ready, my latest book, where I talk about how you know, you go through these emotional times and you see God work things out, but sometimes you've got to wait. Sometimes it's like 20 years later, I realize that stress I went through, now I see the benefit of it, but I didn't get it right away. God calls us to be patient. Now, something else I want to say about doubts. Every doubt we encounter, whether it be an intellectual doubt or an emotional doubt, is an opportunity to learn. And as a scientist, I think this comes easy to me because science is filled with doubts. We call them anomalies. We don't call them doubts. They're things that don't fit our model. However, when they don't fit our model, that gives us some doubt about that model, or it gives us some doubt about the anomaly. And so this is what motivates us to do scientific research. Is it the anomaly that's a problem, or is it the model that's a problem? And often what you do is you make a small adjustment to the model that takes care of it, or you find out that the anomaly was misunderstood. But here's what happens. Every time an anomaly gets resolved, it typically reveals three more anomalies you didn't even know were there in the first place. And so, as you pursue doubts, it's going to cause you to experience more doubts. But the fun thing is, every time you resolve a big doubt, it exposes small doubts, but the small doubts aren't as big as the doubt that you just resolved. And that basically tells you you're on the pathway to truth. If your doubts are getting smaller and smaller and less problematic as you learn more and more, you're on the pathway to truth. If the doubts get bigger and bigger and more problematic, you probably got the wrong worldview, and you need to reconsider your belief system. I actually use that as an evangelistic tool. When I talk to people who are not believers, you know, what is happening to your doubts as you grapple with them? That gives you a clue as to whether or not you're on the pathway to truth or not. However, if you set a goal of having no doubts at all, then you're mistaken. We're human beings. Those doubts will never be removed, at least not in this life, in the next life. But I think you're raising a good point. We need to have fun with our doubts. Find a way to enjoy your doubts. And my own personal experience is the only way to enjoy your doubts is to be looking at the future. Okay, it's not pleasant now, and one way I'm upset at God. However, I know He's going to work things out if I'll be patient. And incidentally, it pays to have fellowship with fellow believers because they can help you through these situations and expose things and attitudes in your own life that may not help you to have that joy. As it says in Romans, count it all joy. Or pardon me, that's James, as you go through these trials. But sometimes we need help in having joy when we're going through the trials. And by the way, trials are guaranteed.
Okay, I think this is going to be the last question.
Since we were talking about decay, before the flood, man lived 900 years old, more or less. But after that, their life expectancy diminished quite a bit. Why was that? Or how did that happen?
Okay. The question was about the change in lifespan. Before the flood, people had the potential to live past 900 years. After the flood, Genesis 6:3 says that God would drop the lifespan to a maximum of 120. As you see in Genesis 11, we see an exponential decline in lifespans from Noah's 950 down to the 120 we experience right now. I just wrote an article on this under my blog, Today's New Reason to Believe, making the point that we now have evidence that that indeed is a hard limit for humanity, where you actually got written evidence of a birth date and a death date that indeed is the limit. The article that I wrote, basically the French woman, Jean Clément, made it to 122 years. And hey, 120 plus or minus 5, that's the biblical limit, again, rounding off. But it turns out that there was a situation. Her daughter actually took on her name. So she didn't make it to 122, she only made it to 99. Now, as a Russian gerontologist, I figured out she's got way too much strength in her back to be 121 years of age. And so the limit now is an American woman who made it to 119. So the limit seems to be real, but your question is why? You'll see this in chapter 13 of Navigating Genesis, where I basically make the point that there are two astronomers that for four decades now have been studying what are called the cosmic ray knee. And what they notice is when they look at cosmic rays, 95% of the deadly cosmic rays, which are called heavy nuclei, fast-moving cosmic rays, come from a single supernova eruption. And the research 30 years ago established it's a supernova that exploded in the last 100,000 years and exploded close to Earth. Their most recent paper, they have identified the supernova remnant. It's called the Mons Serra's ring. It's 15 degrees across in the sky, which again is more evidence that it must have exploded close to Earth. And here's the idea. Before the eruption of that supernova, you weren't exposed to these deadly cosmic rays, at least not to the degree we are today. Today we are, and hence we can't live as long. However, you need more than that to live long. You got to make sure you don't get exposed to igneous rocks. Igneous rocks contain uranium and thorium, and that will shorten your lifespan. Incidentally, those of us who live in the state of California, we're exposed to a little more uranium and thorium than the rest of the population. It shortens your lifespan by 1 month, on average. If you live in Colorado, however, your lifespan is shortened by 3 months because you're at higher elevation. You get exposed to more of those cosmic rays. However, in the days before the flood, humanity was not yet global. They were living in a sedimentary plain where they would not have been exposed to igneous rocks. They were also on a vegetarian diet. Notice in Genesis, they were not allowed to eat meat until after the flood. Now, the reason for that vegetarian diet is if you're going to live to be 900, you don't want to be consuming meat because meat will build up heavy metals in your body. I'm not encouraging you to be vegetarian because if you're only going to live to be 120, you're not going to accumulate enough heavy metals to do you any significant damage. Although there's certain kinds of fish from certain countries you might want to avoid, I won't make any names. They tend to be rather heavy in those metals. But there's a fourth factor. Your telomerase activity would have to be a lot less. You say, what on earth is that? I'm referring to the shortening of our chromosomes. Our chromosomes are designed that they get shorter and shorter as we get older and older. That's actually a good thing. If they weren't getting shorter and shorter at the rate they are, we'd be dying at much younger ages of cancer. The shortening of the chromosomes is actually a check against the spread of cancer and tumors. However, if you don't have the threat of tumors and cancers because you're living in a lower radiation environment, there is no need to have the chromosome shortening as rapidly as they do. But it's because of the shortening of our chromosomes that it's basically impossible to live much past 120 years. So no matter how healthy you live, you're not going to make it much past 120 years. But I'll add this. The average lifespan today is higher than the average lifespan in the days before the flood. When you look at that genealogy, where it shows those people that lived 800, 900, 969 years, they were the relatively few that survived death by murder. To explain why the human population didn't explode to the degree that we would expect if the murder rate wasn't high, we conclude that the murder rate was above 95%. Which means that 95% of humans living the days before the flood had their lives terminated by being murdered by their fellow man. In fact, it's such that the average lifespan in the days before the flood, just the days before the flood, probably was below 40 years. So today, we're actually living longer than any generation of humanity has ever lived. It's a great time to be alive. I can't think of a better time in human history than the early part of the 21st century to be alive. It's a day when we're seeing science giving us exponentially greater evidence that there's a creator God out there that's transcendent, that's personal, that's loving, and a God that wants to redeem us from our sin and evil permanently. So thank you.